All right, welcome to episode number 6 of the Mostly Erlang podcast. And today's topic is Zotonic, and we are continuing our trend of having people in lots of different countries on the podcast. So I think today we have 3 different countries, and 4 if Justin joins us. So guys, why don't you introduce yourselves and tell us, you know, how you came to Erlang and how you came to develop Zotonic, and we'll ask you questions about it.
Yeah, I'm Mark Waddell, and others will come after me then. I am based in Netherlands, Amsterdam, Amstelveen, to be exact. And I came to Erlang from other languages and other web languages, and my background's in building compilers with C for embedded systems. So I'm a bit of a low-level guy, but I ended up in the web development corner. And I realized that Erlang was solving problems that other languages didn't solve. So that's why I started using it and started building Zotonic. But first the others then.
Andreas?
I'm Andreas Stenius. I'm calling in from Visby, Gotland in Sweden. And I joined the Zotonic team in late 2011. And after finding out about it on the Erlang mailing list, where I was idling about, I come from a low-level embedded development environment, doing mostly communication and positioning systems, and I've also done some web application developments for products related to that. And got curious about Zotonic and used it on a few projects already, and here I am.
I'm Michael Kleinhammer from MaxiMonster, which is a young agency developing some platforms in Amsterdam. I met Mark Worrell, now 3 years ago, when I was looking for somebody that could perhaps develop a large, scalable social network. And we went on to build MaxClass, which was, one of the first big implementations of Zotonic. And I actually came from this background of a internet agency with near 40 people, which I sold before I started this, and I had experienced a lot of technology. But when I came across Erlang and saw what Mark had done with Zotonic, I was so impressed. And being the least technical of this group, I decided to start. Kind of managing it to make us successful as a group. And that's what we're trying to do right now. And, I think it's working out very well.
Heard?
Oh, I thought you only wanted a background of people working on Zotonic.
No, you're here, so.
Yeah. So I'm Freddy Bear. I wrote Learn You Some Erlang. I used to work with Erlang in real-time bidding for advertisements. And lately I've joined the Heroku routing team, and I'm working there at a time.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, and I'm Zach Kessin. I work at a company called Product Structure. We're a small startup in Tel Aviv. We're building email pre-built components for web front ends, just a line of JavaScript. And I'm the author of Building Web Applications with Erlang. And I've been building web applications and web pages, since about 1993, 94. I sometimes say I was on the feasibility study for DIRT. Feels like it at least. I've been doing this forever. And I used to spend a lot of time on the bus commuting listening to podcasts, so I became enchanted with the media and decided to, you know, create my own. So here we are. So first question about Zotonic. What's the origin of the name Zotonic? Does it mean something, or is it just sort of something that sounded cool?
yeah, that's a good question. I called it Zofrenic, but that was in the tradition of all the diseases associated with Erlang, like amnesia. And this was from schizophrenic. So because it was, the whole thing was a bit, the whole system, yeah, it was not one thing, it was not the other thing, so I found it a bit schizophrenic. So I called it Sophrenic. But then we started doing a project, and Sophrenic was caught in the spam filters of one of the people working with it. So we renamed it. And then the front-end designer was using the framework, the CSS framework, Atatonic, he called it, from Katatonic. And I thought, no, yeah, and this one is, let's keep it a bit in the same tradition, same tonics, and it's a bit, so a bit fluid, a bit easy to use, isotonic, zootonic. And then we checked the DNS names, of course, you always check domain names, and it was available, so we just continued with that name.
Well, the important thing, can you get the domain name?
That's very important, domain name.
The other important question is always, can you Google it? You know, people have a named language, Go, is like, you know, it's like you type Go into Google, you get a bazillion and one things, I don't know what you're relevant.
Yeah, that's also one thing, that nobody's using it in the wrong context, or that when you type it in, you don't get a certain other kind of websites popping up. Yeah. You don't want that with your name of your product. And yeah, it seemed that this one was pretty safe to use, so we stuck to it. And yeah, there's always some points good enough. So,
And what were like the various design influences you guys were sort of thinking about when you were building it? I mean, what did you come from previously?
Yeah, I came from another web agency. I was there as a co-owner, so I sold my part in that company. And I was a technical guy there. And we had a system called Animator that was built in PHP. And I couldn't bring it along. It was not open source. And I still wanted two projects. And I also bumped against all the problems that you bump into with PHP and real-time web. And very dynamic websites that just doesn't match that well when you have a small team, like one or two or three people. So I took the data model of that system and some IDs of that system. And I took I came across Nitrogen. And from Nitrogen, I took basically started with a complete rewrite of Nitrogen. I took Nitrogen, I put it on Web Machine, added all the early DTL, or a clone of early DTL in the end. And from that, we have been building it out, where it is now.
Our API here is based around Web Machine and early DTL, so I'm familiar, especially with Web Machine. I spend my days in the guts of Web Machine, I think. So.
Yeah. We in the end we use now a fork of Web Machine because we have some strange demands because we are a CMS system and Web Machine is not very has some slight small problems in some corners that we were bumping against. So we in the end our change was so big that Justin was not able to merge it back in his available time, very busy, a couple of years ago in Basel. So we ended up with a fork, but it's okay. We still keep it in sync.
That's a great design. And, you know, I read this sort of description of what you sent me. So there's some influence, it sounds like, from WordPress and Drupal as well?
Not that much, actually. Maybe the front-end designer who wrote the original interface of the admin, which we are still very close to, Tim Bennix, he definitely knew, of course, WordPress, but he knew also quite a lot of other CMS systems when he made it. And I didn't have that much experience with WordPress. I saw the screenshots, but I didn't use it. So it is more based on our other experience with other content management systems, like Animator, but also, just name it. Quite a lot, but more in-house systems.
So the other thing sort of, I guess, is I've never actually used Zootonic. I've looked at your webpage once or twice, but so to somebody who doesn't sort of, you know, has not been in the guts inside it really, You know, what types of things is it good for? What's it that not good for? And like, how do you get started using it?
You start using it by downloading it and compiling and starting it. And then, of course,
well, beyond that,
that's quite straightforward. When you know a bit of command line Kung Fu, then everything works pretty well. Because we also need Postgres, and that turns out to be the biggest hurdle in getting the whole thing running, is getting Postgres installed. So it is not that difficult to get it installed and running. Considering the amount of people we hear back from that are running it, against the amount of people who need help getting it running, then I think it is indeed quite good to do. For the kind of websites, it was first geared towards publication kind of websites, but of course we also made the whole Max class system in it. So there are quite different websites now running in it. So MaxClass is a social network for schools where everything that you do inside a classroom must stay inside a classroom for privacy reasons. So there's really a lot of users with very smallish data sets per class. And then we have other systems, publication systems. One of the more recent ones that came online like last year is Women on Waves. That is are the people of the abortion boat. And they have this problem that once they get on the CNN or BBC front page, that they get a whole lot of traffic and they need to manage through that huge amount of traffic. And in between it is quite normal.
Sort of the super slash dot effect or the...
Yeah.
The term we've used for around here, sort of on a theoretical basis, because we have our company sort of just launching now, is we call it an Oprah, to the theory that if you get mentioned on the Oprah Winfrey show, you suddenly have, 500 extra normal traffic for 72 hours or whatever it is, and then it goes back to normal, or hopefully better.
Yeah. No, actually it's quite good for that because we are have a very aggressive caching system inside, and you can tune it as far as you want. So you can do still in a dynamic way do a lot of pages per second without getting burned down by such a link to mostly only one page, isn't it?
Yeah, it's usually the you get slashed out and just everybody hits your homepage, reads it, and they click one link and then they go away.
Yeah, so it is only, maybe it's 10 pages are really burning hot. and that is really one of the sweet spots of the system, how it's designed to do that very well. And for things like mass classes, this works also very well because in a class context, you have only 20, 30 people working together. So you can keep that easily in memory while the class is active. And they tend to become active and then get silent again, become active, etc. So every time it's a hotspot of activity. And that works also very well. So that is for the kind of users patterns. For the people building websites, we really did look very careful at the front-end developer when using it and the different roles in a project. And that's a big difference with other systems. And that is that we decided that the front-end developer should be in the driver's seat. So he should be able, or she should be able, to make a complete website without too much interaction with the dependency on the back-end developer. So it means that the famous model viewer model, we are still there, but you can access those models directly from the template without any extra backender needed to program it for you. So we see that with experienced front-end developers can make really complicated websites, even with pages communicating with each other between browsers of different visitors without ever talking to a back-end developer.
That would just be JavaScript, I assume, right?
No, it's just templates. Mostly it's just templates. Yeah, you don't need that much JavaScript then, because we develop it first from the standpoint of a publication website or a shop or whatever, and Maxloss, of course. And then the amount of JavaScript is not that big. It's not a big JavaScript model. We keep most templates on the server and then push the rendered stuff using JavaScript to the browser.
Sounds like. I shave a lot of that with, you can define actions in your template that are triggered on events on the client. And you can also hook up to these events from that are sent from other clients. So that's a communication between templates using actions. And
so you basically have client-side events and then events emerging from the client, you know, user clicks on something, and also events emerging from the server that, you know, you can subscribe to where some, you know, user A clicks on something and it generates an event.
Yeah.
You know, so if I'm typing into the chat here, it generates an event on your screen. You know, it says, hey, new chat message type of deal, what you're saying.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, can you also, from the back end, how much of it is, you know, totally programmatic, and how much of it is, or totally, you know, pre-generated, and how much of it is, you know, you actually have to write your own Erlang code? You know, could you build a web app in it and never write a line of Erlang?
You have to write a couple of lines of Erlang. That is the module specification for your site. But actually, you can do that with a command line command, then it writes it for you. So, yeah, you can come around making a whole website without touching Erlang.
Do you know if you have any users that actually use it without knowing Erlang, the same way that you have people using, I don't know, WordPress without understanding PHP or whatever?
Yeah. From the kind of questions we just now then get, yeah. Definitely.
That's nice.
You know, it's certainly nice to have a system based around a solid language like Erlang, which has all the advantages that, you know, somebody who doesn't know Erlang can still use get the advantages, or even somebody who does but wants to put up some content and doesn't want to mess with the code. I mean, for example.
That's true of pretty much any system in any language, though.
True.
As soon as you've got the right abstractions, you can benefit from that, no matter what platform you use underlying it.
I mean, I host the feed for this podcast is hosted on WordPress, on, you know, WordPress's site.
Yeah, what might be good to mention is we probably, because of the interface of the back end, we get a lot of people asking about the similarities with WordPress. And WordPress, of course, is a much older project, so there's a lot of plugins and, you know, millions of modules, and, you know, it's grown into a pretty big, hard to maintain thing. We're not as far with that kind of modularity for people not using any Erlang at all yet. But actually, we just got a grant from Google, from the Google Summer of Code, that we have a bright student who's going to work on the module manager of Zotonic, which is really great. And you know, so we definitely have to grow on that level. So there's the first people that are, you know, less technical working with Zotonic. But at the same time, I think Zotonic is a special system because of its scalability and ambitions to do large projects and complicated multi-server things. So for really small blogs and that type of thing, WordPress is still, you know, of course, very senior and very evolved. And on some levels, Zotonic has to catch up. But on other levels, of course, it's a much cleaner and faster system.
Yeah, I mean, I chose WordPress for the blog for this thing just because it was, you know, hosted. And basically all I had to do was go fill out a form and click submit, and I'm done. And I just didn't want to mess with it.
Well, something that I always hated WordPress for was a very, very poor track record of security. Do you guys have anything in Zotonic regarding that? I mean, WordPress has had everything from cross-site, from XSS to cross-site request forgeries in the admin and everything. Well, is there any kind of protection for that?
Before you get the more interesting technical answers, I can say that last year we did a project for the Dutch monarchy and we got audited by KPMG. It was a Zotonic-based system. And we got compliments. So we're still kind of blushing from that. And they couldn't find anything to that they thought was unsecure about Zotonic.
So do you get to put a certificate sticker on the on your web page, you know, by appointment to?
Well, we actually, yes, indeed.
We should have the royal sign on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, both KPMG and the royal sign. Yeah. You know. No, we didn't get. Actually, somebody from the project got to shake our new king's hand because of the project. But no, on the security level, that project was very highbrow and very serious, and so it was seriously audited. And of course, it was exciting, but nothing came out of it. So, I mean, that's the non-technical answer for your question.
Well, you know, if you're good enough for the King of the Netherlands, probably still Queen Beatrice at that point. But
yeah, exactly.
But, yeah. That's, you know, you don't get much higher than that.
but more on a more technical level, everything that goes into the database is sanitized. So we do stuff a bit the other way around than most CMS systems. Most CMS systems just stuff into the database whatever comes in. We first pull it through a sanitizer, escaper, etc., before we put it into the database. So we don't need to do it afterwards, which gives a nice speed up. That was one of the primary reasons. But the other reason was that it is just too easy to forget to escape stuff when you show it from, when it's coming from your database. So most, it makes it easy for the template builders because almost all data that they can get via model is safe to display immediately. That sanitizer is very aggressive. It uses whitelists. So it throws everything away that doesn't know. And that helps a lot.
I'm wondering for cross-site request forgeries, what approach did you go for that one? If you know it, otherwise I'll just go look in the source and that's going to be the end of it. Yeah.
Yeah. That, we have some areas there where we can optimize it, but one of the things that we do is that every normal postback request is signed. We have a secret key in the configuration, and we signed with SHA-1. And there's also a timestamp in there. That means that you can try to do a cross-site to write a nice a thing, so JavaScript that uses this postback, but then of course you can only use postbacks that are already on the site, or you need to crack the key, and you can only use it for a very limited amount of time.
Because, I see.
That's not nice. Anymore.
That's decent, yeah.
And besides that, we want to do something with the standard stuff, token in the JavaScript, add it on, check it with the session, etc. But just this first line of defense is already so strong that it does help a lot, so that we don't do normal processing of any form. It is almost always an AJAX or postback, and then with some encoded stuff that tells what to do with it.
Yeah. Nothing is unhackable if the guy's totally, but you can make it.
Well, no, that seems safe enough, and if I get it right, it's not being passed through cookies, so you're safe from subdomains being arbitrarily sending cookies and whatnot. So that sounds like at least a decent model that uses tokens and forms.
Yeah, it is a bit different because we don't have normal posts, and but it makes it the whole programming model is a lot easier because of that. And we also use a lot of WebSockets, which makes it, of course, much more fluid, much faster, the whole client-server communication.
Yeah. So now, how is your version of Web Machine different than the standard one? And for those of you who haven't heard it, by the way, I should mention that we did episode 2. It was all about Web Machine. So if people want to learn more, know more about Web Machine, go listen to our second episode. It's of course, still find it online.
Yeah, first off, Web Machine is a really great software. I love it. When I saw it, it was one of the things that made me decide to go the Erlang way, because all that is already solved. Now I can only do the logic. That's really nice. But when we started using it, we bumped into a couple of problems. One was basically performance problems. And the one was that when you add up your amount of dispatch rules, hundreds and upon hundreds of dispatch rules, it's quite normal in a Sotonic system, because we use tens of sites in one system, and then every site has a couple of hundred dispatch rules, so can add up to thousands of dispatch rules. Then you will see that Web Machine has not dispatch rules per site, but a dispatch rule and then the sites for which that dispatch rule is valid. That is not a model we can really use in a content management system with virtual hosting. We really need more dispatch rules per site. So that was one of the problems we bumped into. And the other one was that the Web Machine fetches all those dispatch rules from the environment, the application environment, and that makes a copy. And that slows down enormously the dispatching when you have so many dispatch rules. When you have only a couple, it doesn't matter. It's so many, it does matter.
Yeah, it's a system I'm working on probably has about 20.
Yeah, then you won't see it, but we have 1,000, so then you see it.
Yeah.
And it actually takes up real time, like in the millisecond range at that moment. So we really needed to do something about the dispatch mechanisms and how dispatch rules were organized, and also how they are accessed from the template. So we added named dispatch rules. So every dispatch rule has a name. So we can, in the template, we can say, set place here URL, use that dispatch rule with that name and put in those variables. That makes it very easy to do from and to, so two-way dispatching. And then what we also did was we removed the parameterized modules to start with. Because we bumped in a lot of some variables that were in the process dictionary. We also removed those because we used the process dictionary for very aggressive caching. And now and then we just throw away everything that's in the process dictionary except for some Mojiweb variables. So we couldn't handle too much stuff lingering around there. And one of the last things we did was to add some simple MIMO caching, because Web Machine will call some of your callbacks a couple of times during the request evaluation.
Yes.
And we added MIMO caching for those handlers.
And I see you also have the WebSocket upgrade support.
Yeah. We also added that, yeah. It's upgrade.
Now, if I have a bunch of resources written with the Bashel Web Machine, can I just take your Web Machine port and just replace dropping or...
There are some minor differences, because we don't use the process dictionary anymore. So especially when you start streaming stuff, then there are differences.
Yeah,
when you don't stream, then it is quite straightforward. That all said, we are working on changing the Mojiweb layer in the web machine, to replace it with Ellie. And then everything will be a total different. Everything will be different, because then you will get binaries instead of lists, etc.
I prefer that anyway. The binary versus list thing seems to be my most frequent thing I run into. Sometimes I get a binary, sometimes I get a list. I've just ended up, writing all my half my functions have little case statements. If it's the wrong one, just do a quick conversion and be done with it.
Yeah, we have that too. But with the Ellie conversion, we will be much more binary based all through Sotonic. But actually, I believe Andreas knows a bit more about the whole Ellie story.
Not that much more. I've looked into it. Ellie is a really tight, sleek little, what you should call it, request dispatcher, so you can write your own quite low level controllers to request and even take over the request processing, so you leave Ellie out of it after the initial request has been done. So you can tweak it and do whatever you need to be done. So it looks really promising for our use case.
Sounds good. And you can have multiple Zotonic sites running on the same server, right? So you could have, a couple hundred Zotonic sites sitting on one server, different discrete websites sitting on one server and just all.
Yeah, we have now tens of websites, 50 or so, and we have defined a project to scale it up to thousands. But then we need to redo some of the startup mechanisms in the supervisors, etc., because otherwise we run into nasty timeouts. So we will have to add some state machines in getting everything up and running in a smooth way.
Do you guys offer like a hosted Zotonic service, like sort of like the way WordPress has paid a certain amount per year, and you could just run on their, they have a hosted service and just deal with content? They take care of all the other stuff.
I have plans for offering such a service, but there is nothing done or official yet about it.
No. And there's actually some people in New Zealand also thinking about it. So it's still open.
Yeah, I also talked some time ago to a guy in Austria who also was thinking about it. So there is some interest. And who was somebody who just made a thing? Was it for Heroku? No, it was not for Heroku. It was for something else. And they mentioned you can just start it. And I started running it.
Who will sign it?
Tycho. Tycho. I've been interview. Yeah.
Sounds like you have an assistant there.
Yeah, I have my little assistant, my son.
When I work from home, I get that every so often.
Yeah.
My boys wander into my office and sometimes they don't want to leave.
Yeah, he also sometimes joins in the video conferences.
Yeah. The fun of having kids. Sometimes they help out.
Shh. Shh. That's
some paper, make this deal. Okay.
Zijn
Tycho, ik moet even werken.
Zijn ze
spijsje? Ik moet werken.
I should point out that if we ever actually get this transcribed, our transcriber will not be able to transcribe that part.
That's just Dutch.
She doesn't speak Dutch.
Strange.
She speaks Hebrew.
I know. No, it's very rusty, my Hebrew. Yeah.
Mine's just bad.
So where were we? That was a little intermezzo about the peppermints that were laying on my desk.
That's an interesting question. Does Zotonic how does it do with bidirectional text?
Bidirectional what?
Like, so if you have like Hebrew or Arabic where the text is going in two directions.
Oh yeah, we do that.
Okay.
Do you have your own Unicode libraries to deal with that, or using anything specific? Because Erlang, by default, doesn't really deal with it very well. Or you just pipe in the binary data and let the browser figure it out?
We mostly used to do the binary data. We have we added something to TinyMCE, so you have a plugin, so you can do a little run from left to right, right to left, in the correct direction, especially when you have numbers or use parentheses. It is always a disaster. They always tend up to go the wrong way. So you need to add this direction for short text spans. We also added our own string management for upper lower casing stuff and checking if something is really UTF-8 or not. Mm-hmm. But we try to just pass stuff as is through the system, which of course can't be done when you need an uppercase or whatever. We don't have any uppercase or lowercase mapping of Hebrew.
Well, Hebrew doesn't have uppercase or lowercase, so...
So then it's also good that we don't have it.
It would kind of be an identity function,
Oh, yeah, we have that one.
On a more general level, I might add, Sotonic is excellent for managing multiple languages, both on the level of strings as in the content management area. I know from experience that systems can be really complicated, and Sotonic makes it really easy. We translate stuff all the time, and it's just there, so it's, you know, it's like free to manage translation, so that's really great.
Yeah, I can see it on the Women on Waves or Women on Web website. I think they have like 10, 15, I don't know, languages there. And of course not all content has been translated, but what we do with multiple languages, we translate on a content by content basis. So one page, one content item, a resource we call it, can have multiple languages.
Oh, and then it just uses the language preference header to... That's always nice. It's amazing how many sites don't do that, but offer, you know, it's like there's a local computer vendor here that they offer their website in Hebrew, English, Russian, and Arabic, maybe a few others. But they're not, you know, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't auto just pick it for you. It defaults to Hebrew, and you have to tell it which one you want. Which is silly because your browser sends them the information that says, I want English or French, or it doesn't say French,
honestly.
Or, you know, whatever. And, you know, it's like, it wouldn't be that hard to say, oh, look, he's got an English language browser. Maybe we should give him the English website.
Yeah, but what we do actually is not give the English website. What we do is we do the templates in English.
Right.
That's with just a normal PO editor and pod files. We do that for the template translation and everything, and all the strings, also the strings in Erlang modules are translated in that way. But the content items, actually, we try to match your preference and your what's in your browser header with the languages we have available for that content item. So you can translate your site bit by bit. You don't need to translate everything at once. And we do a fallback to configured preference language or English. Because we assume that unless for Americans, but for non-Americans, that people speak multiple languages. So that when they get when they select Hebrew and they get an English text, they can probably read it. So don't hide stuff that's not translated yet.
Yeah,
that's the whole thing.
Most people, I'd say, most non-Americans can speak more than one language. Non-Americans and non-Brits, I guess. But it's fairly monolingual.
Yeah. Native English-speaking people are often very monolingual. And all the others speak at least two or three languages, unless they don't use computers. But so we have this content item by content item translation, and that is really easy. You just do a checkbox, and then you add another language for your whole system. And you do another checkbox in, on the page where you're editing your on the in the administrative environment where you're editing your page, and then you add that specific language. And you can also say copy everything from English over to this French version, and then just translate it bit by bit. That's also possible. So it is what I have seen from all the other systems. It is one of the easiest to add translations.
I wish we had this conversation 3 weeks ago. I could convince my coworker to build a system in Sotonic instead of...
It's never too late.
It's currently mostly written in Symfony with PHP, so...
Yeah, because we also have like a translated a translation item data type, and that is just a little tuple with first is the atom trans, and then there's a list of translations of that particular text, and the correct translation is picked by the template at that moment by the template compiler.
So I want to go. You said you do a lot of caching. Sort of, how do you go about? You know, I've been running into cache issues in the stuff I'm working on, so I want to sort of.
We do in-memory caching. That is Erlang.
Yeah.
So we have a single server, we do everything in memory, and there's a dependency cache. So we add, when we cache something, we also add dependency keys. And that makes the whole life a lot easier.
Is your cache software, I mean, is it like a separated something that could be used elsewhere?
Yeah, there's a gen server in every that's running for every site, and it's just a couple of edge tables for a quick lookup, mm-hmm. and then when you look up something, sometimes it is copied depending on what you are doing and in which context you are. Like when you are inside the context of rendering a template or inside the context of handling a request, then we also copy stuff that's probably used a lot over to the process dictionary of the requesting process for even quicker lookup. Because often you need stuff multiple times, like when you access a resource, you need the title. But when you need the title, you probably also need the summary and the body, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you just copy the whole thing over. And then for the local cache, we have sort of process dictionary cache. There we just clean it after a certain amount of puts in there. We just throw everything away and start from scratch again. And for the dependency cache, we have a process that that runs and does cleanup and does it by random selection and checking if dependency keys are still valid or not. So slowly it works its way through the whole cache and throwing stuff away. And when the cache is too big, it goes into kind of panic mode and it just starts throwing stuff away.
Mm. Like I said, is that cache infrastructure something that can be used outside of Zotonic? I'm just thinking it would go well with some stuff I'm working on.
I think it doesn't have that many dependencies, actually. But right now it is inside the core of Zotonic. We didn't put it into a separate app or library at the moment.
Random question. Are you getting in any way close to the point where you're saying Zotonic is starting to be hard to maintain internally for the direction you want to take it? Are you starting to think about a second version or a new version or something like that eventually?
No. No.
So it's still easy to maintain.
It's very easy to maintain, actually. Yeah. Sometimes it is a bit difficult when you are inside all the template mess, of course, of an administrative environment. There's just a whole lot of templates, so you have to think, okay, how did it work? But we are very modular. Almost everything is a module, and all those modules are independent of each other, and they communicate using a messaging system, notification, the PubSub system. So they are really disconnected, and that makes it very easy to extend and very easy to maintain also. So we are definitely not bumping into those situations that you think, oh, now it's too big.
Nice.
Are there pre-built images to deploy on EC2 or the like?
I don't know. At some point, Arjen made one. But there was a pre-built image, but I forgot the... we tweeted about it. I forgot who made it.
Or better yet, for local work, a Vagrant recipe would be great.
Yeah, there's a Vagrant recipe. It's quite short, and I've been tweaking with Vagrant as well. I could put something up for you.
Yeah, drop it in the chat. We'll put it in the show notes so people can find it. I actually would like to play with it myself.
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of spare time right now. Yeah. By a lot of spare time, I mean none.
It was a real breeze, actually, to set up.
I'll try it when I get home tonight. Sounds like, you know, fascinating. You guys have done some great work. I'm just looking at your website, and it's like, looks like a really powerful thing. You know, it's like, you know, Rails or something of that nature, or Drupal, but done in Erlang with, you know, good engineering and stuff. And I'm not implying that Rails is bad engineering before anybody sends me hate mail, okay?
Now, we have been called by Read Wide Web, called us the Drupal killer or something, or the new Drupal or whatever. Some people don't like Drupal, but I think it's a good system for what it is.
I will admit the last time I paid attention to Drupal was... 8 years ago. So I don't remember it really well. It was 8 years ago. And second of all, I rather expect that it's changed a bit since then.
Yeah. Now, what I understood from Drupal is that you, whenever you want to do something, also as a front-ender, you really end up writing HTML inside the PHP or the other way around. And with us, our system, that's really not needed. Actually, for Max class, we had a front-end developer working for us. It's before was one of the main people at one of the biggest agencies here in Amsterdam. And he said he never worked in a system that was so easy to use and so powerful for him as a front-end developer. He really loved it. So that was interesting to hear because he had a very huge experience.
What's, and just, you know, on a side topic, and we need to wrap it up soonish. I gotta get going. What's the high tech scene in Amsterdam like? It's, you know, not a city I think of when it comes to high tech, and well, that might be the, I mean, you know, I assume there actually is some, I just don't know about it. So what's it like, and what's the high tech scene like there?
Now, Michiel, that's for you, I think.
Yeah. Well, as in most European countries, it's a lot harder to get money than in the States, but there's a lot happening here. And, I must say Amsterdam, in the past 5 years, I think has really changed. I mean, we have a thing called Appsterdam, for example, which is all about making apps and all sorts of venture capital, events and technology, smaller technology events. So it's really been taking off. I mean, I've been around in the internet scene, kind of since the beginning, for 20 years now. And, it used to be very much the, you know, small web agencies versus very big, IT, companies. And that's changing a lot. We have thousands and thousands of internet companies now in the Netherlands, and a lot of innovation is actually in the Amsterdam area.
Well, that's always good to hear. So yeah. you know, innovation is happening in a lot of places, because I think the more places it happens, the more chance somebody's got something really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to look up at Israel because I think there's a lot happening there.
Oh yeah,
but yeah, it's definitely getting better. And
unfortunately, we had kind of a sad week in the Israeli startup scene this week. Better Place, which was a company we'd all been hoping on to change the world, declared bankruptcy. They were the company doing the battery swap electric cars. That basically is that you could pull into the fence like a car wash, and when your battery runs dead. One's dry, it would just come up and take the battery out of your car and pop a new one in and off you go. I mean, normally you charge it, you only charge one at your house, but unfortunately, after burning through some huge amount of money, they just couldn't make it work.
Mm.
And, that's sad, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of sad because it could have been amazing.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's life. That being said, we've got a pretty amazing scene here. There's,
well, the interesting thing about, I think, living in Amsterdam, working in the technology scene is that we work, very easily with people all over the world. And that kind of, it's pretty much Dutch tradition to, have connections with, lots of other countries, and people speak a lot of languages. So I think that comes quite naturally. And now, I mean, in the past 10 years, working remotely has become such a big thing. And right now, all of us work remotely, and lots of people are doing the most amazing things from home. So I think that's a really great development. It gives a lot of people freedom. Mark, where did our new brilliant student come from?
Ghana or something.
Ghana, I think.
Yeah, cool.
So Google's paying for somebody from Ghana to work with the Sotonic team, and well, actually Andreas is going to be his mentor. So
I think I used to work in the building across town a couple jobs ago. The Ghanaian embassy was a couple floors below me, and it was the Belgian embassy, and the Dutch embassy was two buildings down, and a bunch of other. There's like 12 embassies within a three block, you know, within four buildings. South Africa and Austria and a couple, and I forgot all the others. It was like Embassy Row and Ramat Gan.
Yeah, but actually we have also a Zotonic or a Maxi Monster Summer of Code going on, because we had two really great, bright candidates. And of course, we had only one spot for the Google Summer of Code with the Beam stuff, with the Beam team. And Maxi Monster, as Michiel, basically, decided to sponsor the other student.
Oh, that's well.
So we have two students. The other one is from India.
That's, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Before we exit, let's finish it up. Let's go to the picks in just a minute. But I just want to put in a plug. Lambda Jam is coming up in Chicago. It's about a month or 6 weeks from now. It's July 8th to 10th, about 5 weeks. And if you want to register with code CRASH, you know, they'll give you a 10% discount. Joe Armstrong is giving the keynote. There's going to be stuff on Clojure, Scala, Erlang, Haskell, F-sharp, and probably a bunch of other stuff. It's unfortunate I'm not going to be able to make it, but it does look amazing. So recommend anybody who can go. You should do, and tell me how, you know, send me a tweet. Tell me how it was. Okay, so just why don't we just sort of close out? Any picks for you? Any cool links you want to share with people?
Well, maybe I can just point you out to the blog on Zotonic. We're trying to communicate about the project more than we have been doing, and yeah, I would say visit or follow us on Twitter. So that's slash at Zotonic. Thank you.
All right, Mark.
I don't have that much to add. We have most stuff is on the Zotonic indeed, and yeah, we have other. Of course, you can see the system in action. That's always nice because we still need to add to make a new make some pages that say, "Hey, these websites are running on Zotonic," and then it is nice to know to see some systems that are actually running on it. One is the Max class. That's the school environment we made. I often use this site. That is mimenonweb.org, but that depends a bit on how easy everybody is with abortion issues. That is a customer of mine. When you there is also a big questionnaire, and that is actually your standard functionality in Zotonic to build big multilingual questionnaires.
Fred?
Yeah, first one I have is EarlPass. It's a tiny library I wrote that basically wraps password making operations, so you can use bcrypt instead of SHA or MD5, which is usually not very, very secure. I've been using it for a while. It's stable. Well, I've not been using it, but people have been using it for me. It's tested everything. It does the constant memory comparison so that there's no timing attacks and whatnot. And it seems to be, I think, pretty much close to state-of-the-art in Erlang for the security just because it uses the SmartCat's bcrypt port, which means that you get more control of the complexity than pretty much any other hash functions except maybe scrypt. That also controls how much memory it takes. Second link I have is Characterizing People as Nonlinear First-Order Components in Software Development by Alistair Coburn. And it's a kind of paper about how you can't add a methodology to a given business or whatever that has developers, and that people will basically not be interested in your methodology and learning your system, and they will still deliver correctly otherwise. It's basically telling you to trust your employees in general.
I have to read that.
It's a good text.
Did I get everybody? Mark, did I get you?
Yeah, you got me already.
All right, so I have one link. I think it's on the Times of Israel website. So some folks at Tel Aviv University took a whole bunch of medieval manuscripts that were from Cairo for their Hebrew and Arabic, and they, you know, dated, spanned over 500 years and 320,000 frameworks, and they've been analyzing them with some computing to try and put them together and, you know, figure out which ones were by the same people. So that's really cool. And then if anybody's interested in astronomy, a really great book is The Illustrated Guide to Astronomical Wonders, published by O'Reilly, by Robert Bruce Thompson and Barbara Fishman Thompson. And that's pretty cool. So thank you, guys.